The views and opinions expressed by guests on the TWBC podcast are solely those of the guest and do not necessarily reflect the views of nor constitute an endorsement by the host, TWBC, or the advertisers.
National championships, Confederation championships, World championships, major professional events. For over three decades, he has been there for many of the sport's greatest moments. And now he brings you even closer to the movers and shakers in the world of high echelon tournament water skiing. From the founder and creator of the Waterski Broadcasting Company comes the TWBC Podcast. And now here's your host, Tony Lightfoot.
Well, greetings, salutations, and welcome indeed to this edition of the TWBC podcast. My name is Tony Lightfoot. Glad to have you on board once again. And it is with a distinct pleasure that I welcome my latest interview guest to this podcast. Those of you that are closely involved with trick skiing, or even indeed with trick skiing products, will know this name and know the company with whom he represents and actually owns. The person to whom I'm referring to is, of course, Mr. Russell Gay. How are you doing, sir?
Good, Tony. Thanks for having me with you.
Not a problem. Not a problem at all. So you're here talking to me over the phone from Central Florida. I'm in Baton Rouge, and just a few minutes ago, before you actually made your way to Masterline, the company you own and operate from, what is it, Winter Garden, Florida, you actually dropped your youngest daughter off to gymnastics practice, right?
Yeah, that's right. My youngest one, Ella, she's big into gymnastics, and so she's going 4 days a week to gymnastics. So we had to take her out to gymnastics this morning, and then I'm talking to you from Masterline here. So we're in a new location. We're right downtown Winter Garden. We moved into a new building this year, and that was a big project for us. And but we got a great newly renovated facility in downtown Winter Garden, and great place for skiers to come visit and see our product, and we'll be expanding to have a showroom and everything here as well. So we hope that more people will be able to stop in and see our products and be able to come see us.
Yeah, because I went to your former facility, which was a little ways down the road from Claremont going into Winter Garden, and it was and it was basically a little office attached to a warehouse. And I mean, what kind of struck me about that facility is, it was really straight down simple. You had the bulk ropes and everything, the manufacturing methods and all of that concerned, So I mean, that's what kind of took me back. And it's good to hear that the Waterski the TWBC podcast actually has a little bit of the pleasure of highlighting the fact that you're kind of moving onwards and upwards with Masterline to a brand new facility.
Yeah, we're happy to be in the new location. We're right almost right downtown Winter Garden. We're in a great location, and we just got a really nice new building. We're a much larger facility than we were at, and our plan is to grow it too. And also expand this building and eventually probably bring more of Eagle here and incorporate that here with our business here. We got a whole nother facility in Houston where we make all of our Eagle product. So, which was about the size of the other location that you had been to. But now we've expanded here and have a little bit of room to grow here. And, I think this will be a great spot for us, especially for customers to be able to come. We're right in that area with Winter Garden, Claremont. The ski schools are all close. Mm-hmm. We're right in line with going from all those places to the airport. So it's an easy location for most of the skiers come to Central Florida to visit. So I think that'll be great.
Yes, and producing products proudly built in the United States of America, no doubt. So let's go all the way to the beginning a little bit, because probably not too many people know of your origins within the sport. I mean, you're in Central Florida, but much of what you did in the early days with the sport was up in the Northeast, from as far as I can tell. Isn't that correct?
Yeah, I grew up in Virginia. So, you know, it was something I did Memorial Day weekend till Labor Day weekend, you know, growing up. We lived on a lake when I was very young, but I didn't really ski at that time. And when I was about 10, we moved off of the lake into the little town, which was about 30 minutes from where our ski lake was, or wasn't a ski lake. It was a big public lake. And my dad had grown up in skiing when he learned to ski at camp, and then got really interested in skiing. And then he had built that house out at the lake and was trying to continue going skiing. So that's how I got into it, through my parents. My mom skied a little bit. My dad skied, and they got me into it. And then, it was something I did in the summer through middle school and high school. And my main sports growing up were mostly running. I got into swimming, and I fell in love with triathlon, and I spent a lot of time doing that. So that's what it kept me busy all the rest of the year, but it kept me fit and ready to ski. So when I did ski, I was able to ski a lot. At probably 12 years old, I discovered Bill Peterson's, and my dad sent me down to ski school. I came down to Bill Peterson's, and the first winter, that first winter in like Thanksgiving, and there was only two people there. That was Bill and Randy Schoner, who Randy works for me now. So
wow,
it was a fun time. You know, Randy was an amazing skier. He was a great coach for me growing up with Bill. Bill Peterson was a great place for me to go and learn how to ski and or get better at skiing. My dad had seen him skiing at the Nationals, and Bill really impressed my dad with his toe tricks. He was just so smooth and so clean. And then when he looked at where can I send me to ski school, he felt like that was a good family oriented place. It's located in Central Florida. It was easy to get to for us. And so I went to that's first Thanksgiving. I spent 4 or 5 days down here, which Bill Peterson's is right where I'm at now. I mean, his lake is maybe five minutes from where I live now. So it's kind of funny how that all transpired. But and then I would come down at spring break or Christmas, or, you know, so just ski. I'd maybe ski 2 weeks during the wintertime, and then mm-hmm. I would try to get down some in the summertime. But that was my skiing through until college.
You didn't do any other events than trick, right?
No, I did all three growing up. But we lived on a public lake. The slalom course was, you know, every time you wanted to go use it, you'd have to put buoys in, or you'd go out there and somebody would cut across the course, or you know, the jump course was always a wreck. You know, but I grew up slaloming and jumping and really liking all three events. But I realized, you know, if I'm only skiing 3 months a year and, you know, I was going to Bill's, which Randy was that's what he did. He was an amazing trick skier. Bill was a really good trick skier. And then, you know, at the time, Corey was the guy, you know, it was Corey and Patrice, and those two were so amazing.
And Tori as well.
And Tori, yeah, later Tori. But when I was young, you know, Corey was just a phenom, and it just inspired me. I was just like, wow, that is amazing what they could do. And, in my first Nationals was 78, the 78 Nationals in or 79 Nationals was in Texas. And I went down there, and Tori was the top seed. And that was the first time I met Tori. And at the time, I wasn't, you know, I was just lucky to qualify. I wasn't a good skier, but I got to see Tori ski, and that was really inspiring. I mean, he was amazing. And then we ended up becoming, we all became, I think, pretty good friends. Tori, Corey, we spent a lot of time together. They both had traveled up to Virginia to my parents' house for tournaments. And I came down and skied with Corey quite a bit. And we all had a great competitive relationship and had some hard fought battles along the way. But those guys inspired me a lot to really, you know, improve and get better at skiing.
Yeah, indeed, because I mean, coming to think of it, between like Tori and Corey, you know, between the two of those skiers, I mean, if you were to basically sum up their tricking technique and style, it would be more like a controlled tornado type deal, especially when it came to toe tricks, in and out of toes and that kind of stuff, as you know, in just a blink of an eye, you know, and keeping a very, very high tempo. And you know, with that, you know, I see elements of that with your toe trick skiing. Certainly, when you're competing at the highest level, there, Russ.
Yeah, I mean, they were both a big influence on me. What amazed me was the intensity that those guys skied at, and those guys were, you know, Corey's a fun guy to hang out with now, but you know, he was intense. He was a super intense competitor, and same with Tori. And those guys were ready to go, and they showed up in the tournament. They were on it. And, you know, they trained super hard. I mean, those guys spent a lot of time on the water, as did Patrice. And, you know, I came along behind them a little bit. I think one of my first experiences with them was I got to go to ski school one spring break at Corey's, and I came down, and Tori was not to the level of Corey, but he was on his way, right. And he was skiing with.
Just to interrupt here, when Corey's ski school at that time was at Eagle Lake, right?
That's right. Yes, this was back when he was living in Eagle Lake at his parents' house, and I got to come one time down there, and I didn't know anybody, and I showed up there, and I thought I was okay. You know, I was getting better at skiing, but you know, I was okay, but I hadn't been around any good skiers, and I showed up there, and I think, as I can remember, it was Corey, Tori, Sergio Font, Jorge Font, and I think it might have been Kiko Bazota. So I'm like, I show up and I'm like, oh my God, I'm terrible. Everybody here is unbelievable. Like, they were all amazing, and that was the first time I got to meet them. That would have been 85 or 86, you know, and then. You know, a lot of those guys we're all still friends now. We had Kiko lived with me one summer and really helped me a lot in my skiing. When he got hurt, I think that was in 91, he was amazing three-event skier. And he hurt his knee, and so he ended up at my house and staying there for a while he was recovering. And he pulled me all day, every day, coaching me and really helping me with, especially toe tricks. We worked hard on that. And then, you know, Sergio is a good friend of ours as well now, and Jorge. So it's funny how these people you've met in skiing, just, you know, these are long, you know, long time friendships you end up making in skiing. So that's been one of the big attractions in skiing, I think, for me.
All right, then. So, you surrounded yourself with some of the very best talent. I mean, you mentioned Kiko Bazota. I actually skied a lot against him, you know, during his time as skiing in the European circuit. You know, I was involved at that time, you know, and yes, he was an extremely good three-event skier. Now, at that time, unbeknownst to a lot of European skiers, there was quite an active scene, still is quite an active scene, at the collegiate level. And you ski collegiately, wasn't it for Rollins College, I believe?
Yeah, that's right. So that's, you know, where my skiing really took off. I was just skiing summers and just, you know, but I was doing triathlons. I was competing a lot in the wintertime in cross country, track, swimming, and so it wasn't until I got to go to Rollins and that I really took off. And I it was an amazing time to go to school at Rollins, because I just happened to my freshman year, you know, the incoming class was Drew Ross, who was my roommate, and Tana Britt Larson. So I just was very fortunate to end up starting Rollins with a team with, you know, you already had Helena Shalander, Kim Laskoff, and a few people on the team. And then we had a great incoming class. And then we had just a pretty short run, but we had an amazing team for 3 or 4 years there while I was there. And
led by the legendary Warren Wivrell, right?
That's right. And Warren was a great collegiate coach. I mean, he was very organized. He really had the team, a great recruiter. So he was able to bring in all these people, and Rollins didn't have scholarships. So, you know, none of these skiers were getting scholarships to go there, but he was able to recruit them and get a good group of people there. So that was really a big learning curve there. I mean, Drew was a big influence on me, which is seems kind of crazy as a, you know, he's a slalom skier, but he did three events at the time, and he was very interested in tricks.
Yeah, as is evidenced, you know, down the line, because his daughter is like one of the greatest trick skiers competing right now.
And that's where he learned a lot of the tricks. That was a good thing about Drew. I mean, he really focused on slalom. I think Warren was a great influence on Drew and helping him just start to develop his thought process and his technique. You know, I don't know if he implemented too much of what Warren was teaching at the time, but I think Warren was a very analytical guy that was always working on skis, always working on technique. And then I think Drew is, you know, a very intelligent guy, and he took that, I think, you know, instilled that in him, that you know, to analyze all these things. And he liked to come down, and he would come down and drive for Ton and Britt, and Brent Larson would come and coach, and they would be out there for hours, and Drew would just be, you know, soaking in all the instructions. So he picked up a lot, and he helped me a lot with my skiing as well. And then he would go to Ferraro's. So like a few times we would go down to Mike Ferraro's down in West Palm in the wintertime. We'd go down there. I didn't go as much, but I got to go a few times, and that was really that was a great time to go down there. And I started to learn a lot, because that's when Amrick was down there skiing, and Craig and Jarrett were down there, and Mike and Tangy was starting to, you know, be down there. And Tangy was, both Mike and Tangy really influenced my skiing. And then definitely, you know, watching Craig and Jarrett and Amrick. And at the time, you know, I think the 89, was the 89 Worlds were in West Palm. And at the time I wasn't at that level. I was improving a lot and really quickly, you know, my freshman year at Rollins and sophomore year. And then, at that videotape, you know, from the 89 Worlds, it had such great coverage, and I wore that thing out, and I really analyzed like those skiers. Amrick at the time, that was the first time we really got to see Amrick, and I was like, wow, that was a whole different style of skiing. And then, you know, you'd watch the video of Patrice, and it's just incredibly clean, like crisp, you know, just the skiing was amazing. And so I started trying to incorporate different aspects of those skiers and learn from, you know, what Craig was doing, or what Patrice was doing, or Amrick was doing. And Amrick was coming out with a much shorter rope and much slower boat speed, and everybody was going, you know, Corey was at the other end of the spectrum trying to go really fast. He and Patrice were going super fast with a long rope. And then, you know, I think people started changing up a little bit, and they started bringing it kind of maybe more in the middle there, but you started picking up aspects that why certain things were working for some, you know, body overs maybe. And
yeah, because I distinctly remember the commentary from Dave Benzel at that time.
Oh yeah.
Basically transitioning from one round or from practice into the round of trick skiing, where and hopefully I'm quoting verbatim, you know he cleaned up his tricks by shortening the line and dropping the boat speed in that particular effort, and that produced a world title there from him, you know, under rather controversial circumstances, granted, you know, but you know he came through for the win at that time in 89.
At that time, the judging was totally different. There wasn't the boat judging from the boat. There wasn't the video review and all that kind of stuff. So it was I don't know how they called tricks those, because at that level of trick skiing at that tournament is incredible. And you can't look at the scores when you look back on some of the skiing, you can't just compare scores because, you know, the flips came in and made a big difference. But the level and the quality of the stuff that those guys were doing at that tournament in 89 is really – in 87, if you go back and watch the Worlds from in England there,
yeah.
Man, Torrey had a toe pass there that was just unreal. I mean, I think he did a toe line five front to finish off his run and almost got that in time, which would have been, you know, like a 6,000-point toe pass. Like, it's just the quality was pretty high even back then. But you can't compare points to points because, you know, as time changed, people put more time into the flips and less time into the toes and the maybe the spins and that type of thing. But, yeah, that was a fun tournament to watch, and I learned a lot there and started to try to implement those. And then I think that's really what helped set me on the path to where I was could then compete at that level. And my time at Rollins and being around all those skiers and that kind of thing. And I was still competing in triathlon some, and I started to phase out of that and mostly just focus on skiing or really put my effort into that. So.
And of course, you were involved in triathlon long before it was included into the Olympic program, as far as I can tell. But we can circle back to that a little bit. And I'm glad that you mentioned trick points, because mine and your good friend, John Horton, whom I spoke to in the previous podcast, when I pressed him on the issue on how you would improve the sport, he immediately said, go look at trick skiing and see if there's something you can do with the point values, because they need some serious changing. Would you be in that camp?
Yeah, it's the hard part with tricks and changing point values is it's hard to just, you know, really target each trick and figure out which overall definitely something has to be done. But then it's always about, like, the new things people are doing sometimes seem hard, but as you go progress and you spend a few years doing it, then those things aren't quite so hard. And now when you look at some tricks and you really compare, like, a wake seven front to front or a ski line seven front to front, well, like, those two tricks, which is crazy, is the same point value. You know, they're totally, I mean, to step over the rope is really adding a lot of difficulty. I think the flips are too high for the basic flip. So you have your back flip in reverse, which are 500. That's probably okay. I don't know that those are worth more than a wake seven, but they are on the books. But difficulty wise, I'd probably say they're really not quite as much as should be as much as a wake mm-hmm. seven back to back. And then you go to the crazy part with the point values right now is the flip. You know, front to back, it's you're going from a flip and you just add a 180 and you get 250 points. So, you know, if you did a flip, if you do a front to back, you get 750 points, but then you add a Moab. So now you got to add a handle pass and a front and you only get 50 points for that. So if you did a front to back, you know, flip with a front to back on it on the and landed, and then you just do a front, you get more points than if you do a Moab. And so to me, the front to back is just way too high. And I remember there was a lot of criticism when they made the back to front 550. And when you look at it, a back to front is probably, to me, if I had to go out and do one flip and there's a flip, you got to pick one flip, you don't want to fall and it's freezing cold, I'll do a back to front. That's easier for me than a just a straight back flip. To me, it just feels so effortless to do a back to front flip. So 550, you know, made sense at the time. I was like, there's no risk in that. And so, but I think maybe that was, I wish we could have had the front to backs more on that line, because, you know, now you have like, well, and I started doing Moab 5 front and Moab front to front. I was the first person that was really pushing those flips, but I wasn't really getting rewarded with those for those tricks. But I was like, you know, I wanted to do those tricks. I thought that was going to help push trick skiing forward. And now you watch like Joel Poland, he's doing some really interesting flips, some fun stuff. He's pushing the sport forward, but none of those things are going to score what they are, you know, worth. So, you know, it seems like no matter what flip you do, you get 800 points. So you get back-to-back MOBs are way too high compared to a front-to-front MOB. And then, you know, if you're doing MOB 5 front, you're only getting 50 more points again. So you're only getting 100 points. There's only 100 point separation from a front to back, which is very basic, to a MOB 5, which is a very difficult trick. I mean, you're doing a 540 spin with a handle pass in a flip, and you're not really, you get rewarded for doing a surface 360 more than you would almost the flip, the added 360 in the air with the flip. So, you know, those things need to be adjusted. It's just, how do you go about it? I mean, because as soon as you start wanting to adjust them, then everybody's interest comes in, and everybody starts thinking, how is it going to affect me versus how is it going to affect the sport? You know, it's like what you got to look at it from how are we really how can you look at it objectively, and how is it going to improve the sport versus how is it going to improve me? And
because it ultimately affects the overall as well, doesn't it, for the likes of Poland and Llewellyn, right? And others, right?
Well, yeah, but it affects skiers. So, I mean, individuals and their tricks. I think if you can fix tricks, well, of course, you know, if you're a good jumper or slalom skier, you don't want to, I mean, and you're not that good a tricker, definitely, you know, I guess you'd look at it from a different perspective. If you're going to be involved in the voting, you don't want to see it change, because it might. I think the goal is to try to separate the top level, mid level a little bit more, like to create some separation there. Because now I don't think, you know, some of the guys are getting separated. So there's some guys that are just so much better, but the points don't, you know, tell you that. It's hard to tell. And there's guys like Joel. I mean, I think he really could improve with some better points. And there's other skiers too that could improve. Like, you know, I think Corey and Patrice, they were at a detriment when some of the point values came in for flips, because they had a 5,400 point toe pass, which is had a, you know, a really top level, incredibly difficult toe pass. Mm-hmm. You look at the scores today, nobody tricks over 5, you know. 5,000 is a top toe pass. So, but even that 400 points is not enough separation for the amount of difficulty between a 5,000 and a 5,400 toe pass. There's a lot more difficulty there than what the points are, you know, telling you.
So, yeah, because I mean, I remember back. Yeah, because I remember back in the day, you know, I mean, when ski lines came into being, you know, I mean, phasing out from like the line steps, you know, which has since been outlawed within trick skiing for some unknown reason. But the one trick that really, really, you know, took my breath away was a hand-to-hand wake 7 from Corey Pikos in the 89 Worlds. And I don't think I've ever really seen that many people throw that into their runs, because the ski lines and the flips, as you mentioned, are worth so much more and are easier to execute.
I don't think the ski lines really cut into it. It was the flips. I mean, at the time, you know, that was a trick I started my run with. It was at Bennett. That was my first pro win. I started, was the pause tour at Bennett's, and I had to go head to head with Corey, and I opened with the 7 front to front. And it was the flips that really eliminated that trick, because the body overs, we had those 4 or 5 decent body overs that you would do. And then, we what it did is the flips kind of substituted for the spins. So the flips kind of came in, and you had 500 for a backflip. I'm like, well, I'm not going to do a 7 front to front when I can get 500 for a backflip and a reverse. And then, you know, you got the 750s for the half twist. It'd be worth you putting all your time into getting 6 flips in versus, you know, working these crazy runs where you're doing 3 wake 7s. So that's where I started putting my time in. Because actually, yeah, that run I was doing, I'd start with 7 front to front, and I'd do ski on back, back to back, wake 7, wake 7. And then I would do a back to back and then like a ski line five going inside out. Like it was just a crazy start.
Yeah.
To your run. And I'm like, man, if I can just add six flips in, I don't have to do all that stuff. I can just do four body overs. And I'm, so that's where I started focusing on the, and with the wakeboarding, I ended up getting sidetracked with wakeboarding for a while, which at the time was a perfect timing because that's when all the flips we hadn't really developed the flips and trick skiing. So I was able to spend my time wakeboarding, but also develop my flipping. And I brought that back to the trick skiing. So, I was kind of leading the flips and on the trick ski because of all the wakeboard stuff. And that really helped me there. But,
almost totally forgot about the fact that you were a wakeboarder as well. And amongst all of this.
Yeah, me too. It's a long time ago.
Yes, indeed.
But it was a fun experience. And one of the things that I liked about the wakeboarding was it just opened your views to different things. And you got to, I was at the beginning of it. A lot of us were discussing how is the path forward for wakeboarding. You were getting not just a skier's perspective, but you were getting like people from skateboarding, surfing, like snowboarding, all these different views coming in, telling you how, this should go forward. And you're like, really we're in a pretty small bubble when we talk about skiing. And then he's like, okay, you get a bunch of skiers together and can talk about tricks and how it's going to go forward. Everybody's kind of on the same path. I mean, you got a few small differences, which makes it really hard to change. But when you talk about like wakeboarding at the time, I mean, the views were so different. I mean, one of the first tournaments I came with bindings, they wanted to outlaw the bindings because they thought I was going to have a big advantage because it was all toe straps at the time. And I came with the first set of double boot bindings on my wakeboard. And
because the board's
it was
back.
The surfer side. Yeah, the surfers on the surfer influence was saying, no, you can't use boots. But, would have been a stupid thing at the time because look where it went. I mean, nobody ever.
No, absolutely.
On boots. So, yeah, that was kind of interesting. So you had influences like Jimmy Redman, who was a big wakeboard judge at the time. He was one of the guys in the start. Kind of opened my eyes to different thoughts on how these sports should go. And he always had some really interesting things. So the wakeboarding you got to meet different people and it, learn different things. And that was interesting, And then you still had a few trick judges that came. And I think Mary Gail Holcomb and Nikki Lee were two of the original judges on the tour judging the wakeboard. So, I think they learned a lot too doing that. They got really familiar with all the different flips and it helped their judging when they in trick skiing as well. I think, they got to be really knowledgeable.
I'm just having a hard time, imagining Mary Gail Holcomb and Nikki Lee between them judging wakeboarding, but we'll put that aside for a little bit of a moment.
Yeah, that's a little tidbit people don't know.
Yeah, exactly.
And Jennifer Ellis, she just got a big award this weekend for wakeboarding. And I forgot, it just reminded me this weekend at the awards ceremony how much effort she'd put into the beginning of wakeboard. But
at least so far as the USA water ski and wake sports level, certainly. Jennifer Ellis, she was a rock star, with all of that pro tour stuff, she was the go-to person. If you had a question, Jennifer would absolutely 9 times out of 10 have the answer to any questions you have at a pro skiing stop, no matter where it happened to be, pause tour or wherever. But I want to circle back a little bit to Rollins College, because in amongst all of the skiers there was, I believe, one that you took a fancy to, and you ended up marrying, as I believe it, isn't that right?
Well, yeah, that was, Jane Peterson, my wife now, Jane Gay. She started, I think I was a junior when she started, and, we skied together some. We didn't start dating until after college, but, so, man, talk about a trick. I mean, we had so many good trickers at Rollins between, the Larsons and then my wife, and then we had Liz Lambert. I think we had, who else? We had, like, I think at the Nationals, collegiate nationals, you know, we'd sweep the top five with the tricks, you know, and that would be all over 4,000 points back then. So, yeah, we had an amazing team, especially for tricks. And yeah, Jane was a great, especially toe tricker. She was such a good, clean, smooth toe tricker. And people, I think, forget how good a skier she was back then.
And I mean, certainly running forward. I mean, you started off a great relationship there, continues to this day. And what did you graduate from Rollins for? I suspect it's probably a business degree. I would imagine.
Yeah, that's right. You know, business and communication. So I went into that. That's, yep. So I guess that's why I had an interest in business back then. I was just trying to graduate.
And I'm guessing between you and Drew Ross,
it was hard to get classes and studying in with all the ski.
Yeah, I mean, you had a lake right next to campus, so I mean, you had that access there. And if you wanted to go a little further out, it was just a relatively short drive down the road to Peterson's and that kind of stuff. So, but I was about to say, between you and Drew Ross, I mean, you seem to have pretty good heads for business, and that kind of spilled over into the whole deal with your main business interest now, which is Masterline and the associated companies that fall underneath that banner. But from as far as I can tell, I mean, I looked a little bit into the history of the company, and it wasn't originally formed as a company within the United States, right? I mean, it formed between two skiers from a little further afield, right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, Mick Neville was the one that was the main, Mick and Karen Neville were the main people involved with Masterline. I think
not Brett too shabby Curley a trick, had, trick tricker himself.
That's right. Yeah. And you know, Mick was an incredible overall skier and slalom skier. And he started the name Masterline from him winning overall at the Masters. That's how he came up with the name Masterline for the company. So, and then he was involved. I think Brett Thurley had a little bit of involvement with it at the beginning.
I actually remember there was a picture of them in like a water ski magazine, you know, advertising their products. And at the same time, they were sitting down, squatted down, like eating tubes of Vegemite at the same time, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, probably. Yeah. So, Mick, and then I graduated from Rollins, and then afterwards, and I'd gone to ski it with Sammy a little bit, but Sammy lived out in Windermere where I'd gone out there and skied at his school a few times especially when I was at Bill's. If I just to go somewhere else, I'd go maybe go run over there and ski some with him. And that was another big influence, is really training with Sammy. And the first time I rode a boat with him, just you're just in awe. It's like, oh my gosh. I mean, the intensity level too, because I wasn't used to that. You know, you're used to seeing my dad ski and people like that. And then you go and sit, you jump in the boat and watch somebody at that level. You're like, wow, it's just a whole different deal. I mean, the intensity level that they're training at, and that was even Sammy tricking. He was amazing tricker as well as, you know, overall skier. But Sammy, I rode my bike. I'd come out to Windermere all the time, ride my bike. And one day I rode by and I saw a for sale sign out front of his house. I was like, wow, I couldn't believe he was selling his house, but he had built a house right next door. So he was selling this house. So I ended up purchasing the house that he was selling. And that was after I'd graduated from Rollins. And then, so I got to live next door to Sammy. And my first morning, I remember, you know, waking up and I look out the window and I had overslept, and I opened up the curtains and I was like, there was like 30 people on my beach. And I'm like, wow, what's going on? This was like mid May. And it was everybody there coming to train with Sammy. Cause Sammy had the boat, or he had a couple of the drivers that were going to drive at the Masters. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you look out there and everybody that's skiing in the Masters is sitting on the beach. It's basically on the dock and on the beach. And I'm like, wow,
let's get the tournament done already. Let's get some judges. Let's get the tournament done.
So I was like, just in awe. I couldn't get outside fast enough, you know? And then, so I, I got to grow up, you know, have a and Mick was training with Mick and Karen would train Bruce and Tony a little bit, would all train with Sammy. So I got to know Mick and through that. And then at one point his dad got sick and he just realized, you know, he was trying to bring Masterline to the United States. And it was just, it was something he had just started to do, but you know, once his dad got sick, he just wanted to get home and be with him. So he had talked to us about it. And first I wasn't that interested. I was like, I don't know. But then we thought about it and had another look at it and realized, well, maybe that's a good opportunity to do. So we ended up purchasing it from Mick. And, you know, and that was in 93, I think that was. So I've had it since then. So like September of 93. So
September of 93, which means that next year you'll be celebrating 3 decades of ownership of the Masterline brand, right?
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah.
There you go.
And Randy's been with me since about that time, maybe a year after I had probably owned it about 6 months before I had, and then I had Randy was coming in and helping me a little bit at nights after ski school at Bill's, and then eventually I hired him to help manage it. So, you know, that was probably, I've gotten lucky with a few decisions, you know, and that was definitely one of the ones that was another good lucky decision that I made is, you know, bringing in Randy. Randy's such an amazing guy, and he's just such a, just a great guy to have around and run the business, and he was so knowledgeable. So that's been really helpful for me that helped me be able to keep going with my skiing and still have a business and all that. So,
and certainly with respect, you know, I mean, what's the old business adage? You make your own luck in this world, in the world of business, yeah. I guess.
Yeah. It's definitely about the people, and you got to have the right people. And I've been fortunate to have, you know, at least, you know, we've had our share of not so good people, but we've had a few good people that have just been amazing. And we've gotten, you know, really lucky there. So, that's part of staying in business, you know, be able to stay in business. You got to have the right people, surround yourself with the right people. And, you know, we've been fortunate there.
Even right to this day, because recently you had a one Sean Hunter work a little bit with you over the summer in between his studies at Alabama, correct?
That's correct. Yeah, he was here this summer, and it was so difficult with this environment right now. It's really hard, and so we had a hard time hiring people. So Sean was helping, and Anna was helping, and Ryan was helping this summer, trying to, you know, just get product out because, you know, they were making the ropes, and we put Sean on measuring the ropes. So, you know, he has an interest in them being accurate. So it's,
of course he does.
You got to have somebody, you know, that's really particular about it. So we had him measuring all the slalom ropes this summer. And
so if those ropes were out of homologation, he was the guy to talk to.
Yep. Or probably it was the ones he didn't measure then if they were out, because he did a lot of them. But, you know, when they come in after they try to ski in the morning, come in and help at Masterline. So, I was fortunate to have them help me when times got tough, because it was a crazy year to try to keep up with, you know, it was really difficult to hire any employees. So.
Okay, yeah, and I mean, obviously, the last couple of seasons have been rather hard on everybody. I mean, COVID-19, basically touched every single thing that happened in the entire world. I mean, and including the manufacturing industry, which is what Masterline is essentially is, you know, with the ropes and the accessories and all that kind of stuff. And the raw materials come from somewhere, don't they, in order to make the ropes and stuff like that. So I can imagine how much more difficult it is to actually obtain those and actually meet the demand for those ropes going forward, right? And with that, we'll take a little bit of a break here and conclude this part one of my interview with Russell Gay. We thank him so far for his participation. The next time you hear the TWBC podcast, we will be rejoining him with the answer to that question on part two. So until then, it is ciao for now.
Thank you for listening to the TWBC podcast. Be sure to check out our website at waterskibroadcasting.com. Links to our presence on major social media platforms can be found there, as well as updates to our webcast and this podcast. Duplication or rebroadcasting of this broadcast without written consent of TWBC is prohibited. Subscribe to us on your favorite podcast platform and be sure to join us next time for the next edition of the TWBC Podcast.